All right, everyone. We are on the air live with David Icke. I'm sorry for the initial introduction with Terrence Gardino, although he's wonderful, and listen to my archives, and certainly that's available. But we do want to hear David Icke today, I know. And this is Carrie L's Heartlink show, and it's been quite an interesting last few minutes. But we are ready to go with David. And welcome, David. Thank you for being on my show.
Thank you, Carrie.
And I just want to introduce what you've done. You are quite spectacular, and you have changed the face of the conspiracy that's been underway for some time on the planet, and you've changed it so that we have a fighting chance at this point, I think. In fact, you've written dozens of books that have explained what's going on the planet in terms of this cabal that's controlled everything. And it's been an enlightening experience. And I'm so glad that I have you in my life. And I know a lot of people are happy that you're in their lives. And at this time, why don't you catch us up a little bit? What's going on now? What's the face of this strangeness that we're in?
Oh, good. Well, there's so many levels of it. What's unfolding now, by the hour, never mind the day, is something I was writing about many years ago, and one of the key reasons that people are turning to my information in increasingly vast numbers is what is happening today is in my books over the last nearly 20 years. And that's not because I'm some kind of prophet pulling this out of the ether in a darkened room. It's because of traveling to over 45 countries now over this nearly 20 years, uncovering an agenda for the enslavement of the planet, really, in all its forms. Most obviously, and the key of it, of course, is the enslavement of the human mind, the human emotions, and incarnate human consciousness. And it started off this journey in the most amazing way with an extraordinary series of what people would call supernatural or paranormal events in my life, though they're perfectly normal when you understand the bigger picture of reality. And the years unfolded through the 90s and into recent times where I was on this synchronistic journey where it was like some unseen force was handing me pieces in a puzzle to put together. And it's taken me through an almost endless series of subjects, ancient and modern, which have had to be researched and understood to, if you like, understand the pieces so you can then understand where the pieces go. And the more that the years have unfolded, I've been through the five-sense level of the manipulation, the banking scams, and of course, we're having one of those now. The political scams, the engineered wars, and the engineered horrific events like 9/11. But the more that the years have unfolded, and certainly in more recent times, the focus of my work and the focus of my understanding has been the nature of reality itself, because it's a simple fact that if a few people understand, at least to a very large extent, the nature of reality, how we control it, how we interact with it, how we create it, and through a concerted and cold and calculated effort, they have sucked that knowledge out of circulation of the main population, then they put themselves in a tremendous position of power. Because if we don't understand what reality is and how we are interacting with it, how we are decoding it, how we are experiencing it, but the few do, then we're babes in arms, really. And put another way, we're caught in a fog. We're caught in a fog trying to make sense of something we don't understand. And even worse, trying to make sense of something that we think we understand. Oh, it's just a solid world, and there's God and all that stuff. And so that's been the focus of my work more recently. And so when I talk, like in Los Angeles next Wednesday night, I combine the two because the two have to be connected. It's okay researching the mainstream five-sense conspiracy, but if you only do that, it's in effect uncovering more and more knowledge about our own prison. You know, oh, look at that bar. Look, you see how the light shines off that bar? Isn't it nice? And all the rest of it. And I don't see that it, once we realize we're in a prison cell, that there's a tremendous amount of value in continuing to learn more and more about the cell. What I'm interested then is how the door opens, and or how the door doesn't completely shut, which is the situation we're facing.
And I'm glad you're taking that approach now, you know, because obviously, this is not information for weak souls who can be easily intimidated. This is powerful information, and we need to start now taking the action that is going to get us out of this prison.
Well, yeah, I mean, there are a series of factors which keep people enslaved, and it's enslavement of perception. It's enslavement of sense of reality. That's what it is. It plays out in various ways, which we think are physical experience, but actually it's the enslavement of our sense of perception and our sense of reality. And our sense of possibility, that is also a big one, because if you can suppress and limit people's sense of possibility, then what you're doing is, I mean, it sounds obvious, but sometimes we miss the obvious. You are suppressing their sense of what is possible. And once you do that, it means that you can do things in your agenda of manipulation that are far beyond what the population believe is possible. And so they dismiss any idea that it's happening. You know, you go into the realms of mind control, collective and individual, and people think it's not possible. Now, that's ridiculous. But actually, not only is it possible, and not only is it not ridiculous, it's actually being used at the time collectively on the person who's actually saying it. So it's the suppression and the limitation of people's sense of possibility that is fundamental to this. And also, of course, the four-letter word that controls the word, world, fear. Once you get people in fear, you immediately limit not only their sense of possibility, you limit their sense of what they can do, because fear is a massive limiter of human perception and human behavior and human expression. And most people are who begin to understand that something's going on then fall into the trap of fearing the force that they now begin to understand is behind it. So letting go of fear and letting go of your sense of limitation and your entrapped sense of perception is vital to true freedom, and also to bring in an end to this nonsense that we're seeing unfolding, which is a global Orwellian state, which is unfolding by the day. Those two things, the limitation of sense of possibility and fear, can be eliminated together by a simple thing, which is understanding who we are and where we are, realizing that we are not the image that we see reflecting in the mirror every morning. That's just the vehicle. That's the vehicle for experiencing this reality, which is nothing more than a tiny frequency range, which we are decoding like a television station, like a holographic, apparently three-dimensional, but not really, television station. If you were looking at a television program and then you said to someone that you were the television set, then they'd say you were crazy. What do you mean you're the television set? You're just observing the television set. Don't be so stupid. But that's what we do as a human race. When we look in the mirror in the morning and say, that's me, I'm Charlie Jones or Ethel Smith, we are identifying with being the television set, the decoder of an experiencer of reality. When we are consciousness, we are infinite consciousness that is experiencing this tiny range of frequencies we call the physical world through this telescope or this frequency decoder we call the physical body, or what I call the body computer. So once we identify with being the vehicle, we immediately start to filter reality almost entirely through the five senses. And bingo, we're in the box. We're in the five sense box. Can I see it, touch it, hear it, taste it? Ah, it doesn't exist then. This is why my prime focus these days is on the nature of reality pushing the information to support what I'm saying, which is we are consciousness, and that is what leaves the body at what we call death. That is what is experiencing the continuation of what we call life when people are having what we call near-death experiences or out-of-body experiences. It means, it's out-of-computer experiences. This understanding of the true and incredible nature of who we are. We are not only what we are all that has been and ever will be. But we've just forgotten, we've disconnected an awareness of the true magnitude of who we are. And more to the point, and this is where, you know, conspiracy researchers who don't go into this whole area of reality need to appreciate, is that the key foundation to human control is control of perception. And key to that is persuading people that they are the reflection in the mirror in the morning. And once we buy that nonsense, we are in the box, we are in the trap, and we become mass manipulatable, which we aren't when we start to become self-aware and truly, truly conscious.
This current state that we're in right now, you're saying that we need to take responsibility for having gotten into this situation, because it is about our consciousness. Is that what you're saying?
Well, what I'm saying is, let's you know, strip it down to basics. The number of people who are knowingly in full awareness addressing and advancing this agenda for the global Orwellian or the global fascist centralized state of total human enslavement are a tiny, tiny, tiny few compared with the global population of, what, 6 billion or more, however many is today. Therefore, two things. One, the few can only control that many, because that many do two things. A, they give their power away to the few, often without realizing it, but often realizing it in the sense that they're looking for someone else to be responsible for themselves and their lives and their countries and their communities and what have you. And so that's one key aspect to this. We've given our power away to these people. And secondly, when we begin to understand increasing numbers of people that this is the case, that there are fewer controlling the many, they still believe that the few have power over them, and so they fear to do anything in response to what their understanding is happening. And if we don't take responsibility for the fact that we have created this by giving our power away, and we are allowing it to happen even when we become conscious of at least some levels of what we face, then of course we are completely responsible for what's happening. But there's another aspect to this which is really good news. It means that when we look to turning this around and changing this hurtling towards this centralized Orwellian state, that the power is actually with us if we would only take it back. And what we allow ourselves to do, which dilutes that unity of response, is we allow ourselves to be controlled and manipulated into conflict and divide and rule by the manufactured and ludicrous fault lines of religion and politics and income bracket and culture and color and country. And what we need to do is to drop those fault lines of divide and rule, which are getting us to fight each other instead of looking up and realizing that actually the strings attached to us are and the strings attached to the people we're fighting are actually held by the same hands. When we grow up really and enter adulthood spiritually and in human terms, then we can bring this house of cards down very quickly, because that's what it is, a house of cards. But if we go on allowing ourselves to be divided and ruled, we go on identifying with the image in the mirror, with the religion that we've decided to believe in, with the politics we've decided to follow, with the culture we've decided to identify with, and seeing it as superior to others, and therefore allowing the conflict that follows, then we're heading very fast towards a global version of Nazi Germany.
Yes, yeah. Well, we already see signs of that clearly in the United States, and it's gotten to a feverish pitch, and the chaos now is you can cut it with a knife. And of course, the cabal just loves chaos and keeping us, you know, as you say, it feeds off of our fears.
Well, the thing is, Carrie, that chaos is vital to making sure that the status quo, life as it is at any point, cannot continue forward in that form. So what they're doing all the time is throwing spanners into the workings of society on multiple levels to mean that the status quo cannot continue. And this is happening on multi-levels. And, you know, one of the things I'll be talking about in Los Angeles next Wednesday is the key coordinates that are necessary to understand the world, because the world can seem very bewildering and complex and impossible to understand. But when you have the basic coordinates of where they want to take the world and the techniques used to get us there, then suddenly the world starts to take on a much greater clarity, and you start to see what you couldn't see before. And where they want to take the world is towards a structure in which they have a world government which will dictate to every country, a world central bank that will control all global finance, a world currency which would be not multiple currencies. It would be one world currency, and they wouldn't be physical money in the end. It would just be figures on a screen, electronic money, the cashless society, as they call it. A world army to impose the will of the world government, and a microchip population connected to a global computer. Now, once you realize that that is the goal, that is the agenda, and the technique for taking us there, or the main one, is to continually create chaos, which they then offer the order out of. And every time they offer the order out of the chaos they create, it advances the world in pursuit of that structure I've just described. And what we're looking at in the last few days is the, indeed weeks now, is the creating of chaos in the financial markets and the banking system to provide the order, or the solution, as I call it, problem, reaction, solution, out of that chaos, which is to advance the agenda. And what are we seeing? We're seeing in Europe as well as in the United States, not just big banks taking over small banks or medium banks. We're now seeing big banks, major investment houses, absorbed by mega banks, as a result of we've got to do this to save the world economy, basically. And now we've got this guy, Henry Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, who is a former chief executive officer and chairman of Goldman Sachs, which is a major, major player in the creation of this financial chaos. Through
it's a financial 9/11.
Yeah,
sure.
through the so-called subprime scandal.
Mm-hmm.
And he became Treasury Secretary in 2006. And here is a man from the banking industry who was put in there to through the swinging door that you have between private corporations and government office. And he's now proposing to use incredible amounts of debt between $700 billion and $1 trillion taken on by the United States government, in other words, our generations and multiple future generations, to give it to the banking system to get it out of the very trouble the banking system and people like Paulson and Goldman Sachs have actually created. And in Britain, in the last 2 weeks, we had the biggest mortgage organization in Britain called the Halifax Bank of Scotland, a massive, massive operation and the biggest, like I say, supplier of mortgages in the UK, taken over by another massive operation called Lloyds TSB. And together, that merger, which would have been stopped normally by British monopoly laws, but those laws were put aside by the government because we have to save Halifax Bank of Scotland. And now that mega fusion is holding 40% of British current accounts. We're now reaching a point in this centralization of power in all areas of our lives, most demonstrably now in the banking system, as we're seeing, where we're closing in so fast to the structure that I talked about, which is in the end one global central bank controlling a financial system globally that has very, very few massive mega players to which all people on the planet are dependent for the supply of the unit of exchange, which allows economic activity to take place.
Well, they're knocking off the possible good guys, actually, that could stop some of this. It's almost like they're targeting certain banks that weren't cooperating, perhaps, with the agenda that they've wanted.
And yeah, well, there's two kind of major aspects to this centralization. One is a much further down the road repeat of what happened in 1929 with the Wall Street crash and the Great Depression,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, people think that when there is a banking crisis or a stock market crisis, then everyone loses. No. The people lose who don't know it's coming. The people who know it's coming because they're going to create it, they can make not only a fortune financially, mm-hmm. they can pull together and assemble vast amounts of power over the financial system.
Mm-hmm. They've been predicting this now for many, well, 3 years that I know of.
Yeah, well, they've been doing it for centuries, in truth.
Yeah.
And it's just got more and more and more centralized to the point now where, as I say, we're seeing mega banks taking over mega banks. So if you know that a crash is coming, either in the banking system or in the stock market, then you get out at the highest point in the cycle. And you then get back in at the lowest point of the cycle. So you're buying your competition for a few cents on the dollar because they didn't know the crash was coming, but you did. So you haven't lost because you've known what was happening. You've reacted in the way not to be affected by it. But your competition didn't know it was coming, and so they go under. So after the Wall Street crash and the Great Depression, there were dramatically fewer banks in the United States, for instance, than there were before. And what has happened is the mega players, controlled by people like the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers and these sort of people, had absorbed for next to nothing both the clientele and often the banks themselves into their mega operations. And this has gone on ever since. And so by the time we've reached today, we may see different masks on the face. It might be called Merrill Lynch or Bank of America or whatever. But most of these faces or masks are actually the same face.
So you think Rothschild is the head of this mega bank?
Well, they're right up there. They're right up there. You know, just because it says Bank of America doesn't mean it isn't controlled by the Rothschilds. And the Bank of America, of course, has absorbed Merrill Lynch. And what they do is they set up a series of trusts and then owned by other trusts and other companies and so on. And so the trail back to the real owners is very, very difficult to uncover and doesn't come to light in the normal course of media and you know, mainstream news stories. But what we're seeing is fewer masks on the face, because they're aiming towards, as I said, this centralized global banking system, which will have very, very few different names. You know, they want a massively centralized global system, and competition's the last thing they want, because once you're into competition, then you're into not being able to dictate the outcome before the game starts. And that's what this manipulation is all about. They're not interested in knowing or influencing the game, like in a football game. They're not interested in controlling one side and then influencing the game and let's see how it turns out. They're all, no. They want to know what the outcome of the game is going to be, what the score is going to be before the game starts. And to do that, you have to control both sides. And the more they centralize power, of course, the more they're doing that. And if you go back through the history of the Rothschilds on the banking and financial level of this manipulation, they were through the early part of the 20th century and into the 19th century and beyond, they were obviously mass controlling the economy. Of many, many countries, because they were doing it openly as Rothschild in their many forms. But then, of course, if, you know, everything seems to be controlled by Rothschild, then people say, hold on a second, what's going on here? Because they can actually see that there is a major player, a dominant force within the whole system. What the Rothschilds have done magnificently from a manipulation point of view, though not from an outcome point of view, from our point of view as the population, is hide the extent of their control, hide the extent of their power of the financial system. You very rarely, compared with a few decades ago, hear the name Rothschild all the time in the financial industry. And it still comes up from time to time, but what they've done is brilliantly hide the extent of their power, so they don't seem to be the player behind it all, but they are, along with other forces, but they're a major player. And, you know, when you you look at what's been happening in the financial markets and the banking system in the last few days and weeks, it's classic Rothschild. I'll give you an example. This story is actually in the official Rothschild biographies. What happened at the time of the Battle of Waterloo between the British and the French and Napoleon, etc., the Rothschilds built up for its time, and it's got better since, of course, but for its time, a brilliant network of communication, what we would call intelligence, things like couriers and stuff like that. It was much, much better than the governments of the day. And what happened is that the key Rothschild players in London, particularly a guy called Nathan Rothschild, went to the stock market in London awaiting the outcome of the Battle of Waterloo. If Napoleon won it, then the stocks in London were going to crash. If the British won it with the Duke of Wellington, then stocks were going to soar. And everyone was watching Rothschild because they knew that he was a massive insider who knew things before anyone else. And so what happened is that Rothschild did indeed have a courier system to get back to Britain and Nathan Rothschild how the Battle of Waterloo unfolded. But what happened is Rothschild then started selling stocks very openly, and he had a network of covert agents around the stock market who, on his say-so, started selling stocks and pushing the prices down. And because this was happening, and especially because Rothschild himself was selling stocks, it was taken by the people at the stock market that he'd had the news. Britain had lost the Battle of Waterloo. And they started selling stocks. And the stock market absolutely crashed. Then along came the news that actually the Battle of Waterloo had been won by the Duke of Wellington and not the French with Napoleon. And the stocks then started to turn around and soar. But what had happened between Rothschild openly selling stocks and the realization that the British had won the battle is that Rothschild's agents were buying up the crashing stock in vast amounts without, of course, the people knowing. And at the end of that day, the power and the wealth and the holdings of Rothschild, the Rothschilds in London, had absolutely soared. And they bought them up for next to nothing because they had, through manipulation, manufactured that crash, manufactured the devastation in terms of stock price, and bought them up at that crashed price. Now, what do you need to crash the banking system, crash the stock market? And we've seen it in the last few days and weeks. You need rumors about the problems that certain organizations are having. You then need people holding those stocks to sell those stocks at low prices to stimulate and encourage the rumor in terms of people saying, hey, the rumor's true, look what's happening, stocks are falling. And then you get other people who are completely unaware of this manipulation, though they should know by now if they had any brains worth the name. They start selling their stocks thinking, well, I've got to get out before it really gets any worse. And suddenly that bank or organization is in desperate trouble. What has happened in the stock market and the banking system in the last few days and weeks is just a much bigger expression, example, of the technique that the Rothschilds have been using for centuries to start the rumor, selectively sell stock to support the rumor, and then buy up the crash stock and the crashed banking and corporate entity to increase your power and control for the minimum amount of outgoings. And it's classic, and it'll go on. And
well, it's ingenious.
These idiots in the city will go on falling for it.
It's amazing how this strategy has worked. And of course, the whole setup of the housing bubble and the credit bubble, and the convergence of that happening now just before the elections. What do you see down the road with the American elections? My sense is we haven't seen it, nothing yet at this point.
They're
waiting until after the elections, and then all hell is going to break loose.
Well, again, Carly, it's interesting because we look at the problems with housing and mortgages and all the rest of it, but this is just another repeating cycle. It's a simple truth. If something works, if a technique of manipulation works, then to keep using it. That's the philosophy. And so when you look through history, and even recent history, really, through the 20th century, etc., you see these recurring cycles. And these cycles are possible because the control that the few have over the system. For instance, when you say to people, it's a simple kind of truth, I would suggest. If you don't ask the big questions, you're not going to get the big answers. And it's amazing how few people ask the big questions, like, who are we? What are we doing here? What's the nature of reality? And in terms of banking and money, the big question of what is money and who creates it? How can we understand the banking system and finance without understanding what money is and how it's created? Mm. In the same way, how can we understand the world that we're living in if we don't understand the nature of reality? These are all kind of mirror situations, really. And money is merely figures on a screen. It has no value except that which we put on it. If you have, say, a $50 note or whatever, and it's a fake, it's counterfeit, it will pass through the system, and it will buy anything that you choose to use it for, as long as the receiver accepts it as genuine. So that $50 note, fake, can pass through the system for a long time. Until it's buying things, and people are accepting it. And when they have that $50 note, they're thinking, hey, I'm $50 richer. And then someone holds it up to the light and sees it's a fake. And from that moment on, that $50 note will not buy anything. It's the same $50 note that's been buying things for possibly years. Mm-hmm. And this is what the whole banking system is like. Money is worth something because we accept that it's worth something. Mm-hmm. So we give money and people say, thank you very much, here's some change and here's what you've bought, and vice versa. When actually it's all fake money. It's got no, it's not supported by any real wealth at all. And so the vast majority of money today is figures on a screen. It's not even something you can hold in your hand. And, you know, we're hurtling towards the cashless society as physical money, if you like, goes out of circulation. And what money is fake money called credit, where private banks, the vast overwhelming majority of units of exchange we call money that comes into circulation in the world is actually not produced by governments or anything like that. It's produced by private banks making loans called credit. The more loans they make, the more credit, non-existent theoretical money, in other words, comes into the system. And the more, because we accept it has value, the more economic activity takes place as a result of that circulation of more units of exchange. So the more economic activity takes place, the more things people buy, the more things need making, therefore companies expand and more jobs, people get paid more because there's competition for skills. And what tends to happen during booms like this is that people get into more debt because they get confident. They borrow more non-existent money and sign away their wealth that does exist, like their business or their home, in return for receiving this non-existent figures on a screen money that doesn't actually exist except in theory. And they borrow more money for a bigger house or another vacation or a bigger car, whatever. And then the people who collectively, because in the end it's a cartel that control the banking system and therefore its behavior, the cartel starts to play the next stage of this constantly recurring cycle where they start to take money out of circulation. They'll find excuses, being called currently the credit crunch. It's been called many other different names in different cycles through history. And they take money out of circulation. So what they're doing is that they're removing the units of exchange, or the number of them, so economic activity cannot take place on the scale it did before, because it's not the units of exchange to make it happen.
Doesn't that hurt them, though? I'm not an economic major, but how by destroying the dollar, how does that help them?
Well, they control other currencies, so it doesn't really matter. And what they want to do is destroy all currencies, basically, and replace it with a world currency, which will just be electronic money, which means that there won't be any distinct different currencies anymore. Because the more you remove diversity, the more centrally controlled the society becomes.
All right, so I can see what will happen on the other side of the election is we won't have the money to buy food. We'll all be in a panic state, and we'll just accept any currency that they tell us to. Is that it, whether it be, like you say, the electronic or, I mean, they want us to get us so downtrodden that there won't be any speaking out against it.
Well, they want to put us in such a state of fear and activate the survival mechanisms, which they stimulate and trigger very well. They're overwhelmingly in the reptilian brain, the oldest part of the human brain, therefore they're going to throw many things at us economically and in terms of conflicts, because they want a third world war involving North America, Europe, Russia, and China. It's been long planned.
Well, as I said at the beginning of the show, this is not for the faint-hearted, and if we can't be easily intimidated, if we already know what they're going to try to do, what is next? What do we do? Come together in community somehow? And do you see some of the visions at all for the future?
Well, first of all, I could just mention something while I remember that you just indicated that the breaking down the economic cycle and taking money out of circulation and creating a depression by taking money out of circulation what have you is bad for them. Well, for two reasons, it's not, because they receive in return wealth that does exist for a start, in return for money that doesn't exist when people can't pay back the principal and interest of the non-existent loans they've actually taken out. It's called repossession. But on a bigger level, the money situation is a vehicle to, because they have more money than they could spend in 1,000 lifetimes anyway. It's about the accumulation of money and the control of money and the hijacking of money, so that the population are at your mercy, because you control the units of exchange that allow economic activity to take place. Therefore, choice is to be made by the population. You limit choice massively when you control the unit of exchange. And this is not primarily about the accumulation of more money. It's about the accumulation of more money to accumulate more power. Mm-hmm. So whether the economy goes up or down, they control the game anyway. You know, it's like saying, isn't it bad for football that this team lost and this team won? No, it's not, because football will exist anyway, and football will control the game anyway, whether this team wins or this team loses. So whether Merrill Lynch, you know, wins, against the Miami Dolphins or not, is irrelevant, because the game itself, football, is controlled by these people. So the ups and downs are irrelevant to the controllers of the game.
Now, what's different about this time, though? I want to hear the good news, I guess. I think we frightened everybody enough. Let's.
Well, if this information frightens people, then they have not kind of understood what's going on here. Because, information about what's going on is not something to fear. It's something to cherish. Because what we're now beginning to understand, and this is the a very, very positive aspect to all this, is we're beginning to understand what the game is. And you can start to respond to a situation when you know and start to understand what the situation is. If every day you are turning on CNN or whatever, and you are seeing chaos, and you're bewildered by what's going on, and you're frightened anyway. Never mind being frightened about understanding that what the game is, you're frightened anyway because you're facing a situation you don't understand. Oh, what are we going to do? Are we going to pay the mortgage? Oh, are they going to repossess? Oh, my God. That's happening anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, you get to a point where you're not just frightened, but you're angry if you start to understand what's really going on.
Yeah, well, that's a good start, as long as the anger is turned into action and response and doesn't succumb to fear. So the information we're talking about here in terms of how the game works and what the goal is not something to be frightened of. It's something to celebrate, because we're starting to get clarity on what's happening. And once we get clarity, we could start to think about what to do about it. Now, I was approached in the supermarket a few weeks ago by a lady back in England. And she said, isn't it great? People are listening to your information and reading your stuff. And isn't it great? I said, yeah, it's very nice. I said, it's very nice. I said, you know, years ago, I said, or even less than years ago, when I talked about this stuff, I said, people's eyes used to glaze over. I said, but you know when they glaze over now? She said, no, when? I said, when I say, what are we going to do about it? And we've now reached the point in this understanding where obviously we have to keep putting out the information for those that are still not aware of what's happening so that they can, you know, have access to it and make a decision what they think about it. But you know, for those that have begun to understand what the game is, even if it's not the full picture, at least it's a significant amount, then those people need to start saying, hold on a second, do I keep on just watching this game and understanding more about it, but still doing nothing about
it? And going deeper into the pit, you know.
Or do I say, what can I do here? Because, you know, people have this phrase which they parrot around, and knowledge is power. No, it's not. Knowledge is not power. The use of knowledge is power. If you have knowledge and you do not use it, then you are having no more influence on events than ignorance is having. And with knowledge, with understanding, which is a gift in the world of suppressed information that we're living in, comes responsibility. And we need to ask ourselves now, every day, what have we done today to make a contribution to this dismantling of this house of cards, which is what it is. This power structure is a house of cards, and it is so vulnerable to us and the population in general, because we, the people, are those that are holding it up. We are giving our power away, and that's the power that holds the house of cards together. When we take it back and withdraw our power from this structure, then the house of cards will come down, because a few cannot control billions unless the billions control each other and give their power away to the few. And that's what we've done. And
we can, are there any people in the government that you could say are actually for the people and are aware and are going to help?
Well, no, there's not. But they will be there. But they're operating under the radar. But the thing is that the way the structure works, it filters out the people who are not either aware of the agenda and seeking to advance it, or aware of the agenda and are quite happy to take the rewards for serving it. It filters those people out. So when you get into the upper echelons of government and the whole system in general, you basically, although there will be the odd exception, you basically have two kinds of people. The few who are aware of the agenda, support it, and work every day to advance it, and the many who are either ignorant of the agenda and the bigger picture, but are quite happy to do horrendous things because it's good for their career, and it's good for their income and it's good for their status.
And
others who are aware to an extent of the game they're playing, the advancers of it, but are quite prepared to serve those who are aware and advancing it to, again, advance their own careers and their own status and their own incomes.
Are the presidential candidates aware, do you think?
Well, if you're at the level of someone like George Bush from a significant family within this structure, the Bush family are not at the top of this structure in America, and they're seriously not, but they're up there. In that web, and in terms of Father George Bush, as presidents go, was a significant player, and to an extent still is, within this structure. And so boy George Bush, who is nothing like as high in the hierarchy, of course, as his father, because basically he's an idiot. But he will still, because of his family associations, he'll be absolutely aware of an enormous amount of this game. Not all of it, but an enormous amount of it. And he is one of those people who is quite prepared to serve it in the capacity as president, while putting on a face of being a president for the people. He's actually not president for the people. He's a puppet to be used as a vehicle through the political laws of America, if you like, to turn the agenda and policies decided and dictated in the shadows through his signature on the documents and legislation to bring it into law in mainstream society. He's just the puppet to do that, nothing more. He's the puppet to say, yes, I declare war on Iraq, while other people have orchestrated the whole thing.
And how about McCain and Obama?
Well, McCain will be aware to an extent, although the more I see McCain, the more I think Ronald Reagan, in terms of his mental state. But Obama will be aware up to a point too, and possibly not to the extent of others, but he'll be aware that what he's saying is not actually what is going to happen. Obama's an interesting one, because he's come out of nowhere, apparently nowhere. And people say, crikey, you know, there is some kind of freedom and opportunity
chance,
in American politics, because this guy's come out of nowhere. Well, actually, he hasn't. His mentor for a long time has been a guy called Zbigniew Brzezinski, and this guy is a serious player in the manipulation of the United States and the wider world, actually. There's a network of organizations that operate as one unit around a secret society called the Round Table, which was created in Britain in the latter part of the 1800s, and was fronted, first of all, by a man called Cecil Rhodes, who was a major player, and a Rothschild frontman, actually, in this unfolding agenda across the years. And Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, was actually named after Cecil Rhodes, because he was one of the prime manipulators of southern Africa to allow the British Empire to take over the tribal peoples of southern Africa. But Brzezinski was the creator of one of these organizations, a really important organization, which answers ultimately to this round table. The first one that started was the Royal Institute of International Affairs in London in 1920. Then followed the Council on Foreign Relations in America in 1921, the Bilderberg Group in 1954, the Club of Rome, which was set up to manipulate the environmental movement and is behind the scam of global warming to a large extent. The Club of Rome was set up in 1968. What its most famous member today is a man called Al Gore. Then in 1973 came the Trilateral Commission, which was set up co-founded by David Rockefeller, a major, major manipulator through many, many years and decades in America to advance this agenda, and Zbigniew Brzezinski. Now, Zbigniew Brzezinski is the man behind Barack Obama. He's also got connections into the people around John McCain, which is extremely applicable to the way the agenda works, because, like I say, they're not interested in influencing one side and influencing the game. They want to control the game, therefore they control both sides. Now, if you look at Brzezinski's background, he was national security advisor to Jimmy Carter. And a few years ago, in a Paris magazine, he was interviewed, and he admitted quite openly and with enormous arrogance and coldness that he, as national security advisor to Carter, had set out to entice the Soviet Union to invade Afghanistan. He wanted to give the Soviet Union, the other superpower, as he put it, what he called their Vietnam. And one of the ways that he enticed them to invade Afghanistan was that the government in Kabul at the time, the Afghan capital, was answering to the Soviet Union. It was Soviet-controlled. And so what Brzezinski did, and he openly admitted this, as I say, is he started to fund, train, and organize people in Afghanistan who were opposing the Kabul government controlled by the Soviet Union. And he armed them and funded them and trained them, and these became known as the Mujahideen. And it's now understood that part of the reason, a big part of the reason for the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, was they started to realize that the American authorities were organizing rebellion against the Kabul government. 1 million Afghans died as a result of that invasion. And in his interview with the Paris magazine, Brzezinski, when he was asked what about that and the consequences, basically shrugged his shoulders and said, you know, what's the problem? We weakened the other superpower. That's what we set out to do. What's the problem? Now, because these people are so cold, it's unbelievable. They have no ability, it would appear, to empathize with the consequences for others of their actions, which means that anything goes. But the Mujahideen that Brzezinski has admitted he helped to create when the Soviet Union left Afghanistan became known as the Taliban. And one expression of it, though it's massively overplayed and very American government, British government controlled, became known as Al-Qaeda. And Al-Qaeda means the database. That's how it translates. And it's called that because it was the database of Mujahideen fighters held by the CIA. These Mujahideen fighters were the ones they were funding and training to resist and attack the Russian occupation and the government in Kabul. And so you have a man in Zbigniew Brzezinski who is quite okay with causing that mayhem and mass slaughter to advance some political agenda, and who actually helped to create the very network that they then said, hey, we must have a war on terror to stop these people, when they actually bloody created and trained them. And during this Soviet invasion, they brought a man from the 51st state of the United States, one of many 51st states, incidentally, Saudi Arabia, and his name was Osama bin Laden. And they used him as the front man for this Mujahideen resistance against the Soviet Union. So that's just some, and it is some, of the background to Zbigniew Brzezinski, who is the man behind Barack Obama and has been for a long time. That's why he came out of nowhere, because he had this support of a very significant influence in America behind him. And he's the man saying, I stand for change we can believe in. It's a nonsense. And I watch Obama, and I watch his body language, and he is the most vacuous windbag and fraud that you could imagine. I'm watching his body movement, I'm watching his eyes, and he is, in his speeches, he's going through a script. You can see him going through where to look at a certain time, deliver a certain line, looking straight at the camera to deliver this line, and all the rest of it. And he's a fake. And if he gets in, he'll be a front man, fake, for the real power behind him. But then again, so will John McCain, because, they're two masks on the same face.
It's just one party. It just sounds like we really do, things have got to change in another way. We can't count on politics as the answer. I mean, when you look at Palin, I mean, the cabal is laughing at us. I mean, how much more ludicrous can you get?
Well, yes, it is. And you know, people really, I mean, I do shake my head sometimes when I see often famous people coming out and saying, oh, you know, support Obama. He's a fresh voice. He's a man of integrity and stuff like that. Well, that's the last thing. He's a man of integrity, he's got massive skeletons in the cupboard, as they say. And if they wanted to destroy him and make sure he wasn't president, they'd just reveal some of them, and it's all over. But that applies to McCain also. The idea that somebody's going to come forward as a president of the United States or a prime minister of Britain and actually stand up for what is right for the people as a whole is a nonsense, because the system has been created to prevent that. And long ago, it had reached the point of sophistication where it ensured that no one who was genuinely wanting to do what was right by the people were going to get into those positions. And so any idea that we're going to change by changing political parties or political leaders is nonsense.
It's just not going to happen.
We have to stop cooperating with that system, mm-hmm. not supporting it. And the greatest thing, I mean, I'm not saying that this is what people should do, because it's not for me to tell anyone what they should do. It's for them to decide using their own minds. But, you know, the greatest contribution, in my view, that people could make to this election is not voting at all. But then people say, oh, well, McCain will get in, or Obama will get in, and
well,
I don't like him, or whatever. Well, hold on a second. The people controlling him are the same people. Controlling both of them are the same people. So
yeah.
If you don't vote and one of them gets in that you don't like more than the other one, well, it doesn't matter, because the same force is in anyway. And what you're doing by voting is giving credence to a rigged system. It's like going to Las Vegas. Realizing that the tables are rigged, but still putting your money on the table. I mean, only an idiot would do that, but that's what we do in the political system. The system has to come down, and we can make a mighty statement by not voting.
Well, I think
the idea that we think we have to, because it's some kind of statement of our sense of freedom and democracy, that's all part of the illusion.
No,
okay, you know, you vote for someone for four years, they do what they like without any influence from you, and then you vote for someone else, and then they do the same, and that's democracy and freedom and having influence on your society. Please, you know.
Well, and when I watch it, I just do my best to stay neutral at this point, and I just look at it as entertainment, and I don't get caught up in it because I don't want to give it power. And of course, the more emotional you get over it, the more power you give it. And so, if anything, people, I'm hoping that you understand that to be as neutral as you can during these times, and don't go into staying in fear or anger. Certainly, use your anger, like David says, to act and do something to help the situation. And we're going to come back in a moment to answer more of those questions, but I first want to give the phone numbers to call in, because we are going to take, in this next segment, we're going to take phone calls from the audience. And the U.S. toll-free number is 877-876-5227. The Canada number is 888-815-9756. The international direct number is 530-876-3222. And you have been listening to Carrie L's Heartlink Show with my guest, David Icke. And this has been a fascinating show. And we are going to just announce a couple of things. I'd like you to go to my website, heartlinkinstitute.com, and look up the Revelation page. There's a link to that information. which is gives information about what's been happening and kind of clarifies it for people. And I know David's website at davidicke.com does that, and he has a whole lot of articles on his website. So I recommend you go there. And now we'll go back to David. We're seeing a change, certainly is in the air, where we're getting to the point where we're not going to take it anymore point. Do you see this as an evolutionary process, and as we go into 2012, or what do you see happening?
Well, when this journey started for me 20 years ago, when amazing things started to happen, what you might call paranormal things, and I ended up, when I was still a television presenter for the BBC, and a national spokesman for the British Green Party, I ended up meeting this psychic lady who told me that she was getting information from some other dimension, and that I was going to go out on a world stage and reveal great secrets, and I would face enormous opposition, but they, quote, whoever they were, would always be there to protect me, and what have you. And everything virtually that was said at that time, nearly 20 years ago, has either happened to me or is happening. And one of the things was that within my lifetime, there was going to be what was described as the spiritual revolution, where people would wake up to their true nature. Because wake up is the right phrase, because basically the human race has been put into a hypnotic trance, a state of amnesia, where it's forgotten who it is and what it is. And only by doing that can we be controlled on the vast and collective level that we have been and still are to an extent, and for many people definitely still are to a large extent. And as this as these years have unfolded from 1990, when that happened, and I thought, crikey, spiritual revolution, what's all that about? There was no evidence of that for a very, very long time. But what I have seen in recent years is absolutely that, spiritual not being religious, but being an awakening to a greater awareness of self and the world and the bigger picture of life as we are experiencing it. And it's an exponential curve. You know, more and more and more and more people are opening their minds to this. I mean, you know, when I first started talking about this, you know, I couldn't fill a phone box. And now, you know, sometimes thousands of people come along, which, you know, I hope will happen next Wednesday at the LA Theater, the Million Dollar Theater, when I'm talking for 4 hours about this with a large, large amount of illustrations to support what I'm saying.
And you can go to your website to find out about your speaking there.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. It's next Wednesday, the Million Dollar Theater in downtown Los Angeles, and the details are at davidicke.com. So the idea of speaking at a place like that, you know, years ago when I started on this, was unthinkable. I mean, I was talking in drafty village halls in England, and nobody was coming. So I have almost been a barometer of this as I've traveled around the world. And I've seen it. And it's not just happening in England or America. It's happening everywhere. I've just come back from Croatia, which, of course, was involved in some horrendous conflicts in the 1990s involving, you know, around the Bosnian and Serbian conflicts and the Croatia war that unfolded. And it was extraordinary. I mean, I got off the plane, and this is only about 10 days ago, and I within a very short time, I wondered if I'd arrived at an airport or a spaceport on another planet. I mean, the interest in this information was extraordinary. I mean, just blew me away. And, you know, even the mainstream media were having me on their main television programs at prime time and asking me intelligent, informed questions. that clearly showed that they had done the research and understood what I was saying, and it was just extraordinary. It was amazing. But I'm finding that everywhere, and maybe not to that extent. That was a head shaker level of interest. But all over the world, I'm seeing this happening. I'd spoken in Italy, and it was the same. And you know, I could go to many, many countries and speak because of the interest. Now, unthinkable before. There is an awakening going on. There's no doubt about it. And it's interesting that it is, you know, I mean, people talk about 2012. I think we've got to be very careful that people don't turn 2012 into a Y2K, you know, the idea that everything's going to change at that time. I think it's symbolic of this window of time when there is a vibrational change going on, which, again, came through that psychic 20 years ago to me, that it was a vibrational change that was going to happen, that was going to act like a spiritual alarm clock to, you know, break this amnesia.
Can I just mention one thing? I was reading in the news, the New York Times, and this will give people hope, I think. Palestine State will start with Jenin. I think I'm saying that right. Jenin or Jenin. there's a quiet revolution stirring in that city. It's interesting because it's from the top. People thought that peace would happen from the top down. Well, it's happening from the bottom up, it's saying in the article, where this two societies, the Israelis and the Palestinians, are coming together and starting to create solutions for peace. So that happens on September 12th, if anybody wants to read the New York Times.
Well, the thing is, Carol, I mean, that's just a wonderful example of what I've been saying in the last few minutes about the irrelevance of trying to change the world through the political system. The political system is rigged. It's meant to put people into power who are going to advance the conflict between the mass of the people on different sides, if you like, or different countries, cultures, whatever. We need to walk away from that, stop supporting it, and just say to each other, what are we going to do? Because if you go into any position of a conflict or situation of conflict, the vast majority of people, if they met in a bar, you know, on vacation in that country or whatever, they'd get on great with each other. How are you doing? Hey, have a beer. But they get manipulated into fighting each other when they have no problem or issue with each other, but they're representing sides which are controlled by people who are there to divide and rule. They're vehicles for divide and rule. See, they used to say in the 1960s, what if they had a war and no one turned up? There'd be no war. You see, it's not the people who declare the wars who fight them. No. They declare the wars. They never hear a bullet fired in anger. They're drinking coffee in the Oval Office or Downing Street while the slaughter unfolds. And you know, we've got to start to kind of say, hold on a second. Why am I fighting a war that other people tell me to fight when I have really no issue with these people? In fact, I don't know anything about them. You know, I've talked to soldiers who've gone in and fought in conflicts. They had no comprehension or understanding or knowledge about the country they were going into. And yet they were going in and fight the people there and kill the people there often without just because they were told to. And this is the sheep mentality. You know, I may be controversial here, but I have been known to be. You know, when I hear support the troops, yeah, support the troops. In the sense of when they come home, you know, they're treated with contempt if they have injuries and they're maimed and stuff. Oh no, you're no use to us anymore. So we'll stick you in some hospital and forget about you, and we won't fund you, and we won't give you the money you need to live your life with the disabilities you have. Just you have to get on with it. But in terms of support the troops, I do not support the troops in Iraq. They shouldn't be there. They should never have been there. I do not support the troops in Afghanistan. They shouldn't be there. They should never have been there.
Mm-hmm.
They were manipulated to go there by a false flag manipulated event called 9/11, which was not orchestrated by bin Laden from a cell phone in a cave in Afghanistan. It was not carried out by 19 hijackers flying wide-bodied jets who couldn't fly adequately one-engine Cessnas. It was orchestrated by the very networks that then used that event to justify the invasion of Afghanistan, for a start, and by implication, the invasion of Iraq to stop another terrorist in Saddam Hussein, who incidentally was put there in a CIA coup. And Donald Rumsfeld, the defense secretary at the time of 9/11 and the launching of the war on terror, went to Baghdad to meet Saddam in 1983. Official documents confirm this, to arrange for the shipment from American corporations of chemical and biological weapons for Saddam to use against the Iranians in the Iraq-Iranian war. And they say, oh no, Saddam's a danger. He used chemical weapons on the Kurds. Yes, mate, the ones you gave him. And so,
if they have, you know, any doubt,
support the troops. Let's just take a deep breath here, people. Support the troops. Support the troops to what? To pepper bomb Baghdad full of innocent people? To take part in a conflict that has so far killed and maimed hundreds and hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians? No way. No way. And if we go on being pawns in the game, whether we're in uniform or whether we're saying support the troops in uniform, then we deserve to be manipulated, frankly. Because if by doing so, we are playing the game and supporting the game of global enslavement by the people that declare these wars, and the people that declare them actually declare them on behalf of people in the shadows that you never see. We've got to start withdrawing our support and start reevaluating the way we perceive the world and reality. Because yes, we should support the troops when they come back in a terrible state, and we should give them everything they need. But we also need to stop supporting foreign invasions and foreign slaughters in the name of ludicrous name of fighting for peace.
Mm-hmm. You know, I tell people the best way to use our power right now is to envision through our meditations, envision the cabal disappearing and their bodyguards along with them. And so just see that happening, and the more we can give power to that and just see that the cabal is just being taken off planet Earth and no longer will exist.
Yeah, well, you know, some people have that view, good luck to them, I hope they succeed. But
again, there are a number of things that we can use, and the different tools that we have available.
Yeah, definitely,
we really are more than just this third dimensional being. We are multidimensional, and we literally can create form out of the void, and through our meditations, if we go into the void, we can literally create that happening. So job.
Yes, we can. So I mean, anything that will be a positive contribution is to be welcomed. I mean, this reality is an illusion, and you can use your mind to change the illusion.
What do you say to people who say, well, there are good people and bad people, and we need the CIA and the FBI, and what do you want to say to them in terms of whether we need to lock our doors, and we need to, and all these things, and they equate, protecting our little domains with going to war with Iraq, and what do you want to say to those people?
Well, first of all, let go of fear. I mean, that's the bottom line for everybody. I mean, once you succumb to fear of any kind, then you are in the box. You are in the cell, because anyone who is in fear of anything will look to are in a subordinate position and giving your power away to those you think could protect you. This is the equation that happens collectively and individually. But you know, what you're talking about here, Cario, is very, very important, because the way the system works, it is a structure which can be symbolized by Russian dolls, one doll inside another doll inside another doll. And in this case, it's structures of pyramid structures. If you look at organizations today, any of them, basically, they're all structured as pyramids. You've got the few at the top who know the full picture of the organization, the bank, the government, whatever it is, corporation. And the further you go down the pyramid in these organizations, you're meeting more and more and more people who know less and less and less about what the few at the top know. They know only their contribution to that organization. And in isolation, it can be completely innocent. And you can, well, within the pyramid, not only you can, but the situation is that within the pyramid, the overwhelming vast majority, even in governments, are not trying to manipulate anybody. And to maybe to a lesser extent, but still a substantial extent, that's the case with intelligence agencies and law enforcement agencies, at least what they claim to be, like the FBI, the CIA, etc. And so within these pyramids, like everything else, the vast majority of people will not be knowingly getting up every morning to manipulate the world and society towards this this outcome, this Orwellian goal that they have. And this is a very important point for this reason. You have the agenda, cold, calculated, fully aware agenda, coming down from the few. But to get through to mainstream society and be implemented in changes in society, it has to come through, if you like, the middle management of the pyramid in whatever area of society we're talking about, to be implemented. Because, you know, like I keep emphasizing, the number of people who are knowingly doing this in full awareness is tiny compared with the global population. So they need this middle management structure, whether it's government officialdom or the management within the FBI, below the top level, that is, who have to be manipulated, kept in the dark, be compartmentalized in terms of an understanding of what the game is, so that they will play their crucial role in taking the policy and agenda from above and play it out into mainstream society. Now, if those people start to wake up, and some of them are, to understand what they're actually contributing to, then the whole structure starts to unravel, because the agenda cannot play out if they won't enforce it as they have been doing. And so when you, this information that is being put out now that we're talking about here, when this middle management structure starts to appreciate it and identify its contribution to it, and then has the courage, the guts, the integrity to say, I can see what I'm a part of, I'm not doing it anymore, and to speak out or to throw spanners in the works of the system, then the whole system starts to fall. And if they don't, then they will be playing a major part in making this happen, which their children and their grandchildren will have to face, and they will have to explain to those children and grandchildren what they were doing when this unfolded, that by then, if we do nothing, we'll control their children and grandchildren's entire life, including their thoughts. And I had an experience of this recently. There was a man who, he has a job which on the face of it is to do with railways, but actually he works for NATO. The reason that he's got a job that it seems that he's working for railways and actually he's working for NATO is because what's happening is is the European Union, which is supposed to only fund the European Union with money provided by the people of the European Union, is actually illegally funding a gathering network of railways in Eastern Europe, which are designed to transport the military when the World Army is imposed. This is all going on. And he decided that he was going to start to say some things about this when he looked at his four-year-old granddaughter and decided, oh my God, what's the world she's going to live in if this goes on? And he was talking about when he's in a few years, when he's completed his career and he's retired, he will then reveal everything he knows. Well, I'm afraid. No, I'm not afraid. That's a wrong word. It's certainly not afraid, but I'm sorry to say that in a few years' time, it will be too late. So this is what I'm saying. These people are starting to understand, some of them, that they're a crucial part of this game, but also they've got to take the next step and not put it off until they retire. Not put it off because, oh my God, what will happen to my career? But look into the face of their children and grandchildren and say, you know, how can I not do everything I can to ensure that these kids live in freedom? Because if we think it's getting Orwellian now, and we think the Big Brother state is coming in now, well, we've seen nothing yet. And, you know, we are now facing a massive challenge, and in many ways, in terms of moving to a greater level of awareness, it's a challenge that can have great benefits. A challenge which says, are we going to stand on the other side of the street and just observe all this happening, or are we going to cross the street and get involved? Mm-hmm. Because if we don't, this Orwellian state will unfold within, well within 10 years, at a level of surveillance and control that is massively in advance of even where it is now. Mm-hmm. If we get involved, then the house of cards will fall. Mm-hmm. And that's the challenge we have. And we don't not only have forever to make it, we need to make it now.
What does freedom mean to you, David?
Sorry, Carrie, I didn't hear that one.
What does freedom mean to you?
Well, this is another big area, because it's one of the things I say in my books. You know, if we don't understand what reality is, how can we be free? We can't. We can have various levels of freedom, I can say this or say that in this country, and I can't say this or that in another country. Therefore, one country is freer than another country. We can equate it in those 5 cents daily experience ways. But how can we be truly free when we do not understand that this physical world is illusory? How can we be free when we don't even understand what this physical world is and how we're manifesting it? How we have a collective reality that everyone experiences when actually it's illusory? When we don't ask these big questions and therefore pursue these big answers, we can only be free within a very limited version of what freedom is. Freedom for me, in its true sense, is the kind of freedom that near-death experiences talk about. As one of the things I talk about in my presentations, like in LA next week, I have to go into these things, as well as the 5 cents manipulation, because they're fundamentally connected in terms of not only understanding how the game of manipulation works, but understanding how we can regain our true level of infinite freedom. Near-death experiences talk about the fact that when they leave the body, invariably they do not feel emotion like we feel emotion in the controlled lower vibrational emotional states of hate and fear and worry and all the rest of it. They just feel joy and bliss and love, and they, as one near-death experiencer said, who I quoted in my last book, when I left the body, there was no time. There was not even a sequence of events. I knew everything that had been. I knew what was. I knew what would be. I knew what people thought about me. I knew what they were thinking about me before. I knew what they were thinking about me then. I knew what they would think about me and all the rest of it. Awareness had expanded to such an extent that he was able to experience multiple levels of reality at the same time and be perfectly at ease with doing that. And what happens when we come into this reality through this physical form? It operates like a telescope almost. I was in the bath a few months ago now, and I got this picture in my head, which I got my artist friend Neil Hague in Britain to paint for me. And what I saw was billowing energy, which I immediately understood was like infinite consciousness, the great mind that is all of us, the consciousness that is all of us, the all possibility that is all of us. And then an eye appeared in this consciousness, and in front of the eye a telescope appeared, and on the end of the telescope was the Earth and this solar system, etc. And then a telescope morphed into a human body, and it was extremely symbolic of what happens to us here, where the body is like in many ways it's like a television set. Obviously it's seriously more sophisticated, but it's like a television set in the sense that it picks up a certain range of frequencies. And when we experience reality through the physical body, we are concentrated in terms of our focus and awareness on those frequencies. And those frequencies we call the physical world, the world we daily experience, the one that I think I'm looking at now in this room. But what we really are is infinite consciousness having that experience. We are not Ethel Jones working in an office. We are infinite consciousness having an experience called Ethel Jones working in an office. We are not our experience. We are infinite consciousness. And what the manipulators, who understand this, by the way, have done, they understand it to an extent, that what they've done is they have manipulated people into a false sense of identity. So they identify who they are with the experience rather than infinite consciousness, which they are. Now, once we identify who we are with our experience, we immediately close our sense of identity into a serious level of limitation, because things do appear to be limited within this reality in terms of what's possible, etc., etc., because of its illusory state. But we are limitless. We are all possibility. And when we start to realize the true scale of who we are, we can move our point of observation and observing this world from within this world and experiencing only through the five senses to beyond this world, and we can look into this world, but understand that that's what we're doing. And when you do that, the world, A, looks very, very, very different. And B, your whole perspective on you and life and what matters and conflict and division and dropping bombs on Baghdad suddenly completely changes, because you're no longer in this world. You are, or you're no longer of this world. You're in it physically in terms of your the fact you're experiencing this world, but you're not of it in terms of where you're observing it from. And what's happened is, because people have been manipulated to disconnect, not literally, because we can't, because we're always infinite consciousness, but to disconnect from an awareness that that's what we are, it means that the prime focus for trying to understand ourselves and the world we're living in comes through looking out through the five senses, hearing out through the five senses, feeling out through the five senses. And if you can set up a structure, and this is what's happened, whereby you create a society which pressures people into that disconnection and then controls overwhelmingly the information that the five senses receive from within this reality, then you can A, disconnect someone and isolate their incarnate consciousness, and B, then program that incarnate consciousness with a version of reality and self that suits your agenda for collective global control. And this is why the awakening to the full and extraordinary genius that we are, infinite possibility that we are, is at the bottom line in changing this reality from a prison to a paradise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we try to change things only by doing things outside in this world, what appears to be outside, it's not really, then what we're doing is symbolically, and in many ways literally, we're standing at the movie theater screaming at the screen demanding that it changes. And I see this, to be honest. You know, I watched on the internet the coverage of the demonstrations at the Democratic Convention, etc. And good luck to them. You know, they're coming from, most of them anyway, from a genuine space. They want the world to change. They're sick of it. But, if all we do is shout at the movie screen, the movie ain't going to change. It can't, because it's just a projection. And what we need to do is find the projector and change the reel, change the movie. And that projector is, to a large extent, coming out of us. There may be other elements to that. I'm sure there are. But, you know, we are fundamental to the movie that's being projected. And if we change our inner self, then the projection will change, both in our own we perceive as individual lives and in the collective. And if we change the movie, for instance, from perceiving this reality from within this reality, and therefore getting caught in the conflict and the divisions of race and religion and country and all that stuff, then we will don uniforms and we'll go and pepper bomb Baghdad. We'll think it's okay to do horrendous things. But once you move your point of observation outside of this bewildered reality currently, to the level of infinite consciousness, where you identify who you are with being infinite consciousness that is, always has been and always will be, that is infinite possibility, that is infinite love. Because when people have near-death experiences, I've never met any or read about any who wanted to come back. It's bliss out there. That's what they say. There's just love. And we've got caught in disconnection from that, and therefore we live to such a large extent in a loveless world. Loveless for self as well as loveless for others. And if we move our point of observation, expand our awareness, and we start to identify who we are, not with the reflection in the mirror, but with the infinite consciousness that we are, then the thought of donning a uniform and dropping bombs on people becomes absolutely incomprehensible. It's not even any way we would do that. Would we knowingly advance ourselves at the extent that we cause terrible consequences for others? No, we wouldn't from that perspective. But we would when we get caught in the game of competition and fighting for dominance that we get caught in. Because once we get caught in this reality, we get caught in its sense of division, in its sense of apartness, in its sense of us and them. When we move our point of observation to the fact that we're infinite consciousness having an experience, there is no division. There is no conflict. There is no need to compete, because we're already all that is. This is the expanded awareness that will bring an end to this ludicrous playground that we've allowed this world to become.
Mm-hmm.
And
so,
everything will come from that. Everything will come from that.
So globalization, globalization would be a good thing, depending on our perception?
Well, no. Well, it depends, really. You see, there's a difference between cooperation and organizations that organize cooperation between different countries, different groups of people. So when one's in trouble, the structures are there for the rest of the people to help them, and vice versa. There's a difference between that and a centralized structure that is not there to coordinate cooperation and assistance and mutual support, but is there to centrally dictate, and that's what we're looking at. And
couldn't we change that, though?
The thing is, Carol, that you know, people think that when you talk about oneness and unity, that everyone's the same, everyone becomes the same, and everything becomes the same, and therefore everything in the world is kind of becomes the same because we're all one now. Well, I would say that's a massive misreading of what oneness is, of what infinite consciousness is. Infinite consciousness is infinite possibility. An infinite possibility expresses itself in infinite ways. To express diversity, to express uniqueness, is to celebrate being infinite consciousness. And therefore, you know, we can have structures that mutually support and the rest of it, but we should be celebrating diversity, different lifestyles, different ways of doing things, different ways of seeing things, different ways of life. And we should celebrate them, not say mine's better than yours and let's fight about it. We should have laws against that and all that stuff. Oh, you live next door to me, you live like that and all the rest of it. We should be celebrating diversity because we are infinite possibility. And I have a simple philosophy, which is do what you like so long as you don't impose it on anyone else. And that's the world I want to live in. It's a world, once you come from that point of view, once you come from the point of infinite consciousness and you live that, and you come from a point of view of celebrating diversity, do what you like, so long as you don't impose it on others, that's the key, then we can live in a world of great diversity without anyone seeking to impose their form of diversity on another. And laws become irrelevant. You don't need laws to, say, protect the environment when you've reached a level of expanded consciousness where you wouldn't even consider damaging the earth. You don't need laws that say you mustn't murder when you've reached a level of expanded consciousness where murder is absolutely unthinkable, because at that level of consciousness, all you do is celebrate life. Laws become part of life when consciousness becomes limited and becomes stagnant and becomes myopic. That's when laws start to appear. We don't need laws once we've reached that level of consciousness, because we wouldn't dream of doing things that currently laws say we shouldn't do.
Well, thank you, David. You know, I appreciate your honesty and your willingness to speak your truth. And I just ask others to stay open, and we're these are wonderful times that we're living in, and they're, even though it might not seem that way at times, we really do get to choose depending on our perceptions. So I want to just mention that you've been listening to Carrie L's HeartLink Show and my guest, David Icke. And thank you, David, so much for an interesting show again.
Thank you, and maybe I look forward to seeing some people perhaps listening to this in Los Angeles next Wednesday night, because these events allow people to see that it's not just them that is beginning to change; it's a very large number of people.
Yeah, it would be nice to be with a group of like-minded people, and I will be there. I'm so excited.
And yeah, okay. Well, look forward to meeting you.
Yeah, looking forward to that, and. Next time you'll be listening to my show, you'll hear Patricia Corey, who has written the Syrian Revelations trilogy, and much more. So I'm excited, and thank you again so much for this wonderful show and for listening to Carrie L's HeartLink Show, and thank you, BBS Radio. I'm so glad we've been able to connect and broaden our horizons towards more freedom, light and love. Have a great day. Bye-bye.